Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Friday edition of the Daily Friend podcast. I'm Nicholas Lorimer, your host, and today we have a slightly special edition of the Daily Friend podcast. We are interviewing Nick Hudson from a group who are calling themselves PANDA, which is short for Pandemics Data and Analysis. Now, I think they first appeared in the media yesterday on BizNews, and they've published some material talking about how they think government has been very misled by a lot of the models about COVID that we've seen so far. And in fact, for South Africa in particular and the developing world, there are going to be far fewer deaths than have been predicted by government modelers. Nick, what is going on in your paper? What is your group about? Just give us some background and what your hypothesis here is.
Sure, Nick, thanks for the introduction and thanks for having us on. So the group formed informally in March sometime and in response to data that emerged from the Diamond Princess saga, the very harrowing tale of the people on the boat. And that was a February event, but the first scientific analysis of that story emerged in March. And I and a group of like-minded individuals looking at that information came to a very different conclusion from what I'd say probably could fairly describe as most of the rest of the world came to. Our sense was, after reading that information, that we were not in for a particularly bad pandemic in the coronavirus. We thought it would be sort of slightly worse than a flu, based on that very careful analysis of what went on in that ship. And we were quite alarmed at the panic that the whole scene induced, the very salient situation in Italy, helping to build up a media frenzy around the story, and then the wave of lockdowns we thought were extremely misguided. When our own country went into the state of disaster, we realized that a lockdown was probably coming our way and thought that trying to argue against that was going to be futile. It was hugely popular. And by the time it was over, we would be hardly have made any progress. So we kind of went along with it. And then it became a bit clear to us that this lockdown might not end because other countries' lockdowns went. And at around about that time, we started adding people. Met on the Twitter scene a guy by the name of Peter Castleton, who's a fellow actuary, with whose thinking we were very much aligned. And we brought him in and began to talk about putting together a group that would aim to inform policy regarding the lockdown and coronavirus in general. And that group came into existence with a bang. We wrote an article called Quantifying Years of Life Lost, which was aimed at shutting down the false dichotomy between the virus, the lives lost to the virus, and the economy. This idea that somehow by arguing against lockdown, you were making a choice between money and lives. We thought that was a terribly false dichotomy, and we wanted to frame how the economy and the economic contraction mediates people's lives and therefore their mortality. And so we put together this kind of actuarial analysis that put into numbers the impact that poverty has. And the of course, it's the poverty arising from the economic contraction that arises in turn from the lockdown. And that paper hit about, must be a couple of weeks ago now, with quite a bang. And it had a very interesting effect. The lives versus economy narrative shut down almost immediately. And there was a slew of articles in the wake of that paper, and the whole narrative seemed to shift quite solidly. And people started being able to question the lockdown without being basically accused of being cold-hearted capitalist murderers, you know. And by then, we'd already started some other streams of work. one of which gave rise to, amongst others, the article yesterday. And those streams of work have delivered a couple of interesting findings. The first one is that there are, we believe, clear and material flaws in the SEIR type models that are being used to advise government policy at the moment. We think that they are still, even after dramatic cuts to their initial estimates, still overestimating the deaths that will arise in South Africa from the coronavirus, which is causing the, and it's those overestimates, which is causing the lockdown to be prolonged. And we also found, had a very interesting finding, and maybe I should give a little bit of a preamble to it. When we realized what was going wrong with these SEIR models, we decided to embark on a project of trying to take an empirical modeling approach, by which we mean trying to look at how the pandemics evolve by gauging other countries' experience, trying to look at how the experience of one country differed from another and what the driving factors were in that regard. And in doing that work, we came up with a little tool, which was quite a nifty way of looking at how much curve flattening had actually happened. You know, at that stage, we kind of accepted that some or other effect, positive benefit, came from lockdown in the form of some curve flattening. We questioned how much, but we sort of all shared the opinion that there was probably some benefit. But it was very interesting as we began to look at the actual data. We tried to correlate two different measures of the stringency of lockdown with the actual duration between the first day of death and the peak deaths. And what we found was that there was absolutely no correlation. So no causality between lockdown and flattening the curve. The whole aim and ambition of lockdown has not manifested in the 66 countries for which we have data at the moment. And we found that quite a shocking story. So that summarizes the three bits of work. One, the pandemic is a lot smaller scale than was initially spoken about. And I think it's important to put this in context. You know, when the Imperial College model came out, the prediction for the UK deaths alone is a number that it looks like the whole world might not reach.
So
this overestimate.
Just could you go into exactly what really is the difference between your approach to making these predictions and what the sort of mainstream view has been? What do you think they got wrong? What was their biggest mistake?
Okay, so I think there are three or four things going wrong in these models and the modeling teams. The one thing that's clear to us is that these teams tend to consist of they're highly balkanized teams. It's people all of the same kinds of qualification, very similar political mindsets, very similar skill sets, often, employed by the same type of organization. They're very undiverse groups. And here I emphasize diversity of viewpoint less than diversity on any other metric. I think it's important at a time like this that's where the emphasis should be. That's problem number one. Problem number two, they're dealing with models which we believe are over-parameterized for the purpose that they serve. There's just too much uncertainty, too much of the unknown to be setting models up with as many parameters as those models have. The third thing is that the formal state models, as they're called, these SEIR, which models, they fall into a class of models called state models, state transition models. We think that they are not formally fitting the actual observed experience, and that the hypotheses that are implicit in those models are not being tested, and or rather instances of falsification of those models are not causing the models to be withdrawn. There's a failure in the scientific method. And that failure goes to quite deep philosophical levels, but it's widespread. We believe that those models have not been, they've been refuted every day for months and continue to be refuted. So those are the criticisms that we have of that whole class of modeling and the way in which this exercise of producing forecasts is being conducted, and a failure to reconcile them to real world events, you know. So the classic situation is they will observe that the country they're trying to predict for is tracking slightly differently, and they say, that's emerging data. We'll update our model for the emerging data, but the model remains wrong. You know, it's still being refuted, even if it's tracking the actual death numbers or the case numbers or whatever they're trying to predict, simply because other inferences of the model are not being found to hold in practice. A classic one here is that all of these models imply that when you release lockdown, there should be a massive resurgence in deaths. And so, that is observed nowhere.
How much do you think of the wrongness of the models could be attributed to something like voluntary social distancing? So the fact that without government orders, a lot of people took their own health into their own hands and really tried to avoid contact with other people.
I think it's almost an impossible question to answer because there are no counterfactuals. That's what people do. And to assume that they don't do that would be in itself a mistake. There's a lot of evidence that the bulk of social distancing occurred prior to the introduction of lockdowns. And so lockdowns only serve to provide a modicum of extra social distancing. And that in itself is a damning finding for lockdowns, because the incremental economic damage and societal fabric damage, psychological damage that stems from the imposition of hard lockdowns is massive. It's multiples greater than the actual economic damage that stems from the disease and the disease plus the panic. I think it's useful to put divide the economic damage into those three bins. You know, disease by itself, which is a negligible impact because this is, you know, we're talking about a few weeks of extra mortality for the world in the context of a world where whatever it is, 60 million people a year die or something like that. Where worldwide there might be 500,000 deaths, you know.
Is it not possible to argue that social distancing, for example, has... voluntary social distancing, so I'm not talking necessarily about lockdowns, has hurt the economy in of itself. So you say that the disease itself doesn't really cause that much damage, but because people are staying at home and not going to restaurants and that sort of thing, that's causing a lot of economic damage. And I'm thinking of, I think, Sweden. So they've famously not been that heavily locked down compared to a lot of other European countries, and yet their economy still looks like it's going to shrink by sort of 6%. Do you think that that's a big... Do you think it's possible to untangle lockdown from voluntary social distancing as well?
Yeah. Our economics guys have done a lot of work on this, and it's very clear that the incremental impact of lockdown. I mean, I'm not for a moment denying that there isn't an impact from the reaction to the disease. Definitely restaurants, definitely movie theaters, definitely cruise ships, definitely airlines, tourism. You know, all of those things are severe. Okay. But the incremental damage that comes from, you know, saying, okay, well, yeah, so your revenues would be down by 10-20%, whatever, you know, depending on what sector you're in. But actually what we're going to do is take them down to zero. This is a freakish economic experiment that's never been conducted before. Even wartime doesn't involve that kind of draconian step, okay? So these lockdowns do massive incremental damage relative to the normal reaction to the disease. And we're seeing this in the numbers. You know, the very amusing thing for us is pro-lockdown hardliners, as we call them, the Flat Curve Society, are always telling us that, you know, the impact's going to be the same for Sweden or Norway. And, you know, there's no difference, you know. And when we ask them how they know that, they tell us, no, well, the forecasts are down 6% and down 6%, you know. Well, you take your forecast and put it, you know, where I prefer to look at the emerging information, and there the case is extremely strong. Well, on a number of metrics, whether you're looking at car sales or producer and manufacturing indexes, all of those measures point to there being a very strong relationship between the stringency of the lockdown and the depth of the economic contraction. It's very strong, not just a kind of the hint of a correlation. I mean, they line up like, you know, the waves on a beach. So there's no question there, and it's a sure sign of ideologically committed person who tries to argue one of two things, either that there isn't an incremental economic contraction from lockdown. That's one sure warning sign of a madman. Another one is a person who tries to argue that economic contraction and the poverty that stems from it isn't at all bad for people. You know, ultimately that poverty doesn't kill. And sometimes you get both those arguments in the same head, and then you know you're dealing with an insane person.
So we've had an enormous amount of debate, particularly in the sort of wealthier first world countries, like the US, like Italy, yeah, like the UK, about what the actual number of people dying from COVID is. There's some people who say that it's overestimated, and that there's others who say that, for example, retirement homes are not being counted properly in the final death tolls. If, for example, the latter is true, that in fact the death toll is significant amount higher, do you think it would be significant enough to affect your predictions here?
Yeah, at the moment we don't have a firm view of whether there's an undercount or an overcount going on. We have a firm view that anybody who claims it's all in one direction is, once again, of the ideologically committed variety and therefore should be ignored. But we see this movement in both directions. You know, there's certainly something weird going on with the American data, the CDC information, which we have a little bit of access to, is showing a surprising thing. There's a dramatic fall in a time series that's usually incredibly stable, cancer and heart attack deaths. You know, you can normally predict those to within 0.1% of the death total. Both those measures have currently plummeted in the United States. So it would appear that coronavirus is a cure for cancer and heart attacks. Or maybe that the US government is incentivizing hospitals with its coronavirus subsidy to report deaths as coronavirus deaths. And that kind of thing works in the direction of overcounting. Yes, surely there will be some people who slipped away in their sleep in old age homes and will test corona positive. That would lead to an undercount. But then there's an even bigger question of the difference between dying with coronavirus as opposed to dying from it. And I think that that's also something that has to be untangled, you know, especially with respect to it presents a particular challenge for unmanaged HIV deaths in this country, which come in at the rate of about 6,000 a month, I think. You know, those people will die with all sorts of infections present and not presenting probably with the classic symptoms of coronavirus. And so how do you categorize them? You know, so there will be all sorts of questions like this. It will be, I think, a statistical nightmare to try and unpick them all and work out what actually went on. So for our purposes, though, we think, you know, okay, yes, it's an interesting discussion worth having. There's no avoiding it, but it doesn't change the bigger picture.
So a lot of the, of course, coronavirus appears first in the People's Republic of China, and one of the other countries hit very early on was Iran. And both of these nations responded to the pandemic in a very untransparent, authoritarian way. China, of course, locks down millions of people in Wuhan and in some other cities, allegedly, you know, welding people into their apartment blocks. Iran, there were stories, although none of them have really been confirmed, that the Iranian Revolutionary Guard had done things like cordon off cities and had sort of military quarantines, that kind of thing. How much of the world's response do you think was affected by two things? One, the sort of uncertainty about the data coming out of these authoritarian nations, and two, how much of policy was driven by sort of just copying the Chinese model, do you think?
Look, there's no question that the World Health Organization has shown, you know, itself to have been enamored with that kind of hardline kind of response that China demonstrated. They have clear, deep sympathies with this kind of approach. I mean, the ultimate evidence of this was this ridiculous announcement of Tedros last week. He's saying that, you know, no country should emerge from lockdown until contact and trace testing is fully under control, which is a ridiculous thing to say in the face of an epidemic, you know, where the majority of cases are sitting in an asymptomatic basket out there in the wilds. You've got no idea where they are. You know, that's effectively condemning most countries in the world to indefinite lockdown. It's a shameful, shameful recommendation of policy, and one of a number of things that the World Health Organization has done in this epidemic, which I think are deeply disgraceful and could well, when the dust has settled, I think could lead to the end of that organization. I think their mistakes have been that bad, and the costs of those mistakes are going to be so consequential and with us for so many years. And so I think, yeah, they're falling in love with the kind of communist hardliner approach was a big part of the way they've gone about this whole story. In my mind, you know, a lot of these policy pronouncements have been completely and woefully inadequate for open societies, for democracies, for developing economies. We believe that no developing economy should be in lockdown at any point. It's a humanitarian disaster.
All right. So, in light of your hypothesis here that the number of deaths is going to be much lower in the final tally, and that obviously we should end lockdown now. Is there anything else that you think we should do? What are your sort of final thoughts on this?
Yeah. Look, we need to start thinking in terms of how to prepare for post-lockdown worlds. There are a couple of challenges. Between the World Health Organization and the media and social media, and a really good job of terrifying a lot of people has been done. We surveyed people let me be precise. An NGO with whom we work surveyed people in the townships, and 78% of the respondents believed that the disease represented an equal risk of death to all people, you know, which is far from the truth. Less than 1% of your population is at risk of death from this disease, and it's a reasonably identifiable group. So most people are simply not at risk. And you see this in the reaction that people have towards schools opening and city headlines shrieking that you're sending our children to death and all of that. There's no risk, no material risk at all to kids. I would happily send my children to school. I wish they would go back to school now. I think this lockdown is psychologically very difficult for them. I think there's a project required to undo misinformation, fake news in effect about the pandemic. And then I think we're going to have some very careful strategies for how to deal with the massive institutional damage that's taken place over the last 6 weeks. We will emerge from this with many institutions no longer in existence, many jobs no longer in existence. Freedom is the only format that is compatible with growth. We've seen that and proven that to ourselves over the last 20 years. As government control and central management of the economy has increased, so growth has fallen. The excuse that South Africa is structurally a low-growth society is complete nonsense. No country in the world is structurally low-growth as long as it's got people in it that has vast potential. And we need to tap that vast potential. I mean, you would have to do so. The only way to do so would be by liberalizing our markets to a considerable degree and allowing the work of the market to attract capital, to bring in capital formation that will be required to replace those businesses. It'll take years. This won't be done overnight. But we've got to start thinking about what steps we would do in that regard. And I also have a feeling that there's some, you know, in all the frenzy to lock people down and decide what chicken they may eat and what shirt they may wear and all this nonsense, we've missed golden opportunities to complete the rollout of ARVs to unmanaged HIV cases, to provide opportunities for old people who wish to quarantine themselves while the epidemic washes through. Bear in mind, our view is that that doesn't take long. It's a short cycle, not a long one like these SER models are predicting. There are any number of initiatives that will be required to address the harms done by lockdown in the health sector. So, for example, how do we catch up with the ghastly news I was hearing this morning of the drop off in management of tuberculosis cases from 2,500 a month to 1,100 a month in visitors for serious unmanaged tuberculosis cases. What are we going to do about the missed cancer diagnoses, about the missed vaccinations? You know, all of that is stuff that needs to be dealt with. Otherwise, we risk, you know, each one becoming a tragedy as big as coronavirus itself. And, you know, I could go on. I mean, there's probably a list of 50 major health issues that are rearing their heads, each one of which is comparable in size to coronavirus. That's how mad this panic has been, how deranging it has been. So yeah, lots of work, and we will be preparing a piece on that over the next couple of weeks.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the show, and it was good to have you here because I think Gabriel Krause and I on our own podcast discussed this issue. We think that one of the big problems in this debate has been the shutting of sort of intellectual doors, that we haven't been able to have the proper opportunity to have a proper public discussion about how to respond to these issues. It was sort of a mad rush and then an entrenchment of groupthink. And it's very important to hear alternative viewpoints to make sure that society is not going down the wrong path.
I totally agree with you. The ultimate evil is to shut down the means of error correction.
Exactly. Anyway, thank you so much for coming on the show. And if you liked what you heard here, there will be a little bit more about it on the Daily Friend in the coming days. If you would like to support our efforts to bring alternative viewpoints to you through podcasts, through writing, through research, through policy analysis, please do become a friend of the Institute of Race Relations. You can do that by going to our website, irr.org.za, and clicking the Join Us button. Sign up to give us a small monthly donation and support the work we do. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll catch you on the Monday edition of the Daily Friend Show.